In times of need, a safety net that enhances low earnings for families with children, puts food on the table, and encourages self-reliance, as Wisconsin Safety Net does, makes a big difference in combating market-driven poverty. But as this year's report suggests, cuts in that safety net without substantial improvement in the underlying economy can produce an increase in poverty. That's from the just-released Wisconsin Poverty Report from 2013. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
How do we define and measure poverty? How does Wisconsin's poverty rate compare to the rest of the country? What does the recent poverty report from June 2013 reveal about Wisconsin's most vulnerable residents? What might the solution be to poverty? Joining us is Timothy Smeeting, director of UW-Madison's Institute for Research on Poverty and the ANS Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. Thank you, Emily. Nice to be here.
Last time we spoke, it was about recession, and I suspect we will not be too far from that topic today.
We're still living it.
But first, what is exactly the source and the purpose of the poverty report?
Well, the Wisconsin Poverty Report was stimulated in part by the Wisconsin idea that the Institute for Research on Poverty, which has been here since 1966, is part of the university, is nationally and internationally recognized, ought to be able to say something to Wisconsin residents about what the situation with poverty in Wisconsin is. So I joined Governor Doyle's task force on poverty and told him that, unlike some other governors, he shouldn't announce that we're going to make poverty go down in the state because we're just entering a recession and poverty's going to go up. I don't care what you do. And so he said, well, what should we do? I said, we should make better use of the programs that we have, in particular SNAP or Food Share, the food stamp program, which feeds people, and the Earned Income Tax Credit, which makes earnings go a little bit further from families with children. So we started in 2008, and this is our fifth report. And the reason we do this is because the way the Census Bureau officially measures poverty is inadequate. It was designed in the 50s for a 1950s world. Taxes aren't considered at all. The two programs I just mentioned, refundable tax credits from the EITC and the SNAP Food Share, we'll call it Food Share, which is the Wisconsin label, the Food Share program is not included. And this is where we've spent billions of dollars in helping fight the recession. So if you want to find out how well we did getting through this recession in an era where there weren't enough jobs to support families, and there still may not be, what we really have to do is to look at the efforts we put forward and see how well they do. And so that's why the Wisconsin Poverty Report came to be. And I think I'm happy to say overall, bottom line is that the safety net still makes a very big difference in Wisconsin. But market-driven poverty is still going up, meaning that not enough is being generated in earnings for the poor to escape poverty just on their own self-reliance. Wages are really low. There are a lot of $9-an-hour jobs out there, but many of them are part-time. They don't include child care. You have to pay for health care and so forth and so on. And you have to take all of this into account. And so we've done this in the Wisconsin Poverty Report. And I might also add, just as an opener, it is a model now for the state of California. I just reviewed their report, which is based on ours. New York City did it just before we did. They're also good allies. Minnesota has one. Dave Reimer uses some of our stuff and other stuff in the Community Advocate Center in Milwaukee. And so this is a good idea, and a lot of other people are doing it too, because you deserve to know what's going on in your own state.
Is there some irony if the poverty report is in danger of continued funding?
Yeah, well, it is, in fact. The Census Bureau gave us startup money as a model for other states. And so we ran out of startup money a couple of years ago. And we tried to raise some money this year, particularly in Milwaukee, where the difference in poverty rate within Milwaukee County from neighborhood to neighborhood goes from 35% in the middle to 5% in Whitefish Bay and Cedarburg and other rich areas. But that didn't work, so I'm hoping to raise some money so we can do it again next year. We did it essentially on fumes this year. It's a short report. It looks a lot like last year's, because it is like last year's. And we'd like to do it again, but I have to raise some money somewhere from somebody. And we'll see how that goes over the next year.
Before we talk about the state of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Poverty Report specifically, can we back up and talk mm-hmm. about poverty at the federal level? Because there's a lot of programs that use the federal poverty mm-hmm. index, you know, the measure that is where you, if right. you're a family of four, you can get a number. Yes. And some programs will go up to 150 or 200% of that and so on if you're qualifying for Head Start or for energy assistance or other things. Can you start sort of at the federal level and tell mm-hmm. us what's done there to define and measure poverty and why you'd even need to sort of, I guess, specialize in terms of a state?
Absolutely. Well, see, part of it, you just hit yourself, Emily. Do you see any programs that are available only to people who have half of poverty or 40%? No, that's because the poverty line, which is the federal poverty line, which is $22,000 for a family of four, is too low. It's unreasonable. Mm-hmm. So the programs that we aim at people in need are all 150%, 130%, 200% of that. And mm-hmm. that's because it's really low. But the issue is the following. The federal government distributes about $300 billion a year on formulas in part that have to do with the state's level of poverty as officially measured, which just means cash income against this poverty line from 1955. And what happens is that gets further and further from the truth the more we spend on non-cash programs and other factors. So here's an example. In the official poverty measure, the cost of living in Minot, South Dakota, or Fort Smith, Arkansas, is the same as New York City or Chicago or Waukesha. Okay? That's not true. We know that. Mm-hmm. But suppose
you're saying the cost of living is concerned.
You mean they don't make any adjustments?
They make no adjustment. The point is they don't make it. But a new supplemental poverty measure, which is sort of the federalized grandfather of the Wisconsin Poverty Report, there is one at the national level, makes that difference. And it makes a huge difference. So suppose you're a senator from North Dakota, and somebody says some of your money depends on this formula under the current poverty measure. They want to put in a new poverty measure, and they want to adjust for cost of living. So the poverty line in South Dakota is going to fall, and the poverty line in New York is going to go up. Gee, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out poverty is going to go down in South Dakota, poverty will go up in New York, the New Yorkers will get more money, we'll get less. We can't do this. So the first thing the federal efforts say is this is not a substitute. And, in fact, it's called a supplemental poverty measure. And, in fact, the grandmother of the supplemental poverty measure is our new chancellor, Rebecca Blank, when she was at the University of Michigan and when she was the president of Association for Policy Analysis and Management. She wrote her presidential address on how we really need to do this, and she helped guide it through to this point where it's there. And now people who want to know how programs like food share and refundable tax credits affected poverty need to go to either the supplemental report for the nation or a report like our Wisconsin Poverty Report, to look at what goes on inside Wisconsin.
The politics of poverty is an interesting phenomenon. You would think, on the one hand, that it would be to the advantage of the North Dakotan senator, representative, governor, to say, oh, look at our state. We have, you know, decreased poverty. We're prospering. Let's not even talk about the whole oil thing in North Dakota in particular. But to be able to show off that your state is prospering, that it has improved, even though it is a statistical phenomenon. But they don't seem to care about that.
That's money. If that costs the state of South Dakota or North Dakota, you know, 10 or 15 million in federal grants, they probably wouldn't like it, even though, as you're absolutely right, in those states right now, you can afford it because of all the revenues they're getting from oil. I just think it's better to have a measure that makes sense to people so people have information on, well, we spent money here, what good did it do? And that would really help, for instance, in the current environment where we're trying to cut food stamps or SNAP in the federal level, the state level, and everywhere, because it helps too many people or because too many people are needy. And I was telling Emily, I need to go no further than last Friday night on PBS when David Brooks said, that's stupid. These people need to eat. They're hungry. Now, David Brooks is not, you know, is generally regarded as a very reasonable fellow, middle of the road, a little right generally. And so this business about we have to slash the food stamp program, I think, is totally misguided. It makes a huge amount of difference in the way that people live now. It feeds people. You can only use it for food. I have been on 2 radio shows and on 4 TV shows, from everybody from Cory Booker to the county administrator in the county of in Maryland, in Montgomery, yeah, Montgomery right. County, who've been trying to live on $29 a week of food stamps, which is what you get with food stamps, and have realized you can't do that.
Right. I think there were some congressmen that tried that,
yes,
too.
Yes, many people have tried it. And so on the one hand, you've tried it, you can't do it. On the other hand, it's too much or we can't afford it. To me, it's ridiculous. And the way you get around it is to show how these programs affect poverty, that this program actually does reduce poverty, that it feeds people. It doesn't buy booze. It doesn't buy even toilet paper, because all that is forbidden. It buys nothing but food.
Mm-hmm.
And it is targeted at people with incomes below 133% of the poverty line. So family with 4 below $32,000 could get food stamps or food share. And you get a lower amount, obviously, if your income is closer to $30,000. But it makes a huge amount of difference. And we know that when kids are well-fed and when families are fed, they're healthier, they do better, and so forth. So it's to me, you have to do things like our report to show that, in fact, these programs do make a difference, and Wisconsinites should be proud and happy that they have this program in their state, this federal program, and they're making the most use of it they can, and it's helping.
Is that the impetus behind saying that we should cut food stamps and these other programs, that they're not making a difference? They're really saying that?
The impetus is that this is a crutch, that, you know, you put your feet up on the table. You're getting $287 a month worth of food, and so you don't worry about the rent or anything. You just put your feet up on the table, and, you know, you live off of that. So it's Congressman Ryan has said, you know, that it's in some sense too much of a free lunch. And so now we want to go out and do things like force people to work if they're on the program, even if they can't find work. Our Legislative Audit Bureau did a beautiful report in May of 2011. They reviewed the program. They said our state program has won awards for making fewer errors on the front end, meaning getting the people who need it quickly, and on the back end, meaning getting people off who have been done. We serve 1.1 million people, and it's over $1.1 billion in this state a year. And on about page 4, there's a line that 522 people, that's 1,100,000 out of that, 582 who are getting food stamps or food share were in jail. And that one, unfortunately, was in many of the state's newspapers.
That's all
that was
got,
the headline.
Yeah.
That was the headline. Yeah. 582, you know, people. I mean, what happened? These people got food stamps. They got arrested after they got them.
But it's a tiny percentage.
And the same thing with the idea that people sell their food stamps. Okay. Sometimes you can find a person who has a food card and they'll give you your card for somewhat less cash, but that's a really desperate person. That's a person who has to make a decision between, well, am I going to pay the rent at the end of the month and get thrown out of the apartment? Or better, the way it's done, according to Matt Desmond, is, well, unscrew your front door, take off your front door permanently. Mm-hmm. Or am I going to eat? And you can go to the food kitchen and get some food. Or you can go to the pantry and get some food, Second Harvest, other great organizations we have in the state with supplement food stamps. But your landlord isn't going to take flour and beans and rice as payment for your rent.
Right.
And that, again, is a tiny, tiny fraction. And the cost of enforcing that is astronomical.
One of the things that struck me reading through parts of the poverty report is, if I read it right, that children in Wisconsin, the poverty level has gone up among children. And I know I recently did a benefit at my house for Porch Light, which houses homeless people. And the director there said that the average age of someone who's homeless in Wisconsin is age 9.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow this face of homelessness being a 9-year-old, and this the notion in your report that some of the people who are most affected by poverty are children, is it definitely stays with me. What do you think accounts for the fact that the poverty level among children in Wisconsin has gone up despite these safety net programs that are supposed to be there?
Well, the first thing you have to realize is that compared to the official poverty rate, the Wisconsin child poverty rate is lower. It's lower because food stamp program, a food share program, and refundable credits especially help families with children. If you have one, two, three children, the more children you have, the further your earned income has to go, and your earned income tax credit responds to that. But what happened over the last year, however, is first thing that happened is we got rid of the making work pay tax credit, which was worth about 8% per dollar earned, and we put in its place in 2011 only a 2% Social Security payroll tax cut. So you lost 6% of what you earned right there, and so if you made $10,000 a year, that's $600 fewer you have. And then we cut back on the state EITC in Wisconsin. We said that you got 14% of the federal amount, and now you're only getting 11%. So that's another couple hundred bucks.
Why was that cut made?
You'd have to ask the people who made the cut five blocks down the road. I don't know. Maybe they wanted everybody to tighten their belt a little bit, and that's what they needed to do. The money, in part, the money that pays for the Earned Income Tax Credit Program comes from TANF money, which goes to the Department of Children and Families to help subsidize people who aren't working. And, you know, I mean, we don't give people money anymore for taking care of the kids alone. You have to go out and make an effort to work. We have a nice child care system in our state. We have the Badger Care health care system, both of which really help. And so they decided rather than taking the money for this purpose, we should give the money to add to the return for going to work. And maybe a little less went over. Maybe they economized somewhere else. But it just, it hasn't been cut again. But it was cut. And you could cut it if we were recovering, if we weren't 48th in the country in terms of getting jobs back that we lost in the recession. If
we're, Wisconsin is still 48th in the country.
48th. We're on an upward tick, though. We've added maybe 20, 25,000 jobs, and hopefully we'll add more. Everyone's coming out of this recession, and my fondest hope of doing this report next year is to show that the rate of poverty based on earnings went down and that we relied less on these programs because that's the way it should be. But right now, you know, if you talk about homeless kids or kids who are just a little bit from that, and we all know that kids who eat well and have a school breakfast and a school lunch, much less a good meal from food share, are much more likely to do better in school. So we're all worried about how well kids do in school. We have to feed. The first thing you got to do is feed the bloody kids for pizza.
And house them.
Well, and house them. Mm-hmm. And you know, try and give their parents the support so they can go to work. And try and find an inexpensive way for them to get their health care, which we know is really expensive. And so we do okay in all of those dimensions, and they all make a difference.
But, if you're talking about an average age of 9 for poverty, that's really where the whole educational system begins to go well or badly is back around kindergarten. I mean, if those students don't succeed, then they're not going to likely to succeed later in life, and the whole system gets
impaired. We really have to attack the whole life course. I mean, poverty in Wisconsin, as we measure it, did go up this year significantly from last year. For children, it went from about 11 to about 12.5%. And that's below the federal level of 19, but it increased by more than the federal level, actually. And so our kids, while they're doing better, are getting a little bit worse off. But the whole thing now, I'm a member of the American Pediatrics Association Task Force, and they're vitally concerned about issues of nutrition. So they're interested in what happens from conception until the child gets ready for preschool. Then there's another group worried about preschool. In this very city we live in, there's huge drive now to make the public sector schools work better for lower class kids, for African American kids and other minorities who aren't doing as well, and so on. And then it's about thinking about going to college and not taking shop and so forth. So it's a whole full court press.
And there's
kids,
poverty among the elderly as well. I mean, the whole spectrum.
The elderly are doing better. The elderly are doing better because of the Social Security system.
Is there and was there ever a valid argument to say that Wisconsin would be a welfare magnet?
I don't think so. I remember the days when, certainly not after W-2, certainly not after that, but I remember the days when I was a graduate student here, and there was a fellow who worked at the state named Bernie Stumbris, and he did a study for the Legislative Audit Bureau of Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Illinois. When he compared Wisconsin to Minnesota, turns out benefits were better in Minnesota. So if you wanted to emigrate from poverty, you didn't come to Wisconsin. You went the other side of the river, okay? You stayed on their side because you did better. We offered a little bit more than did Illinois, but most of the poor single parents from Illinois turned out to be the kids of people who had summer homes in Door County, and when they went to have a child, they went up there. The idea that you would also move for a couple hundred bucks, the major safety net most people have in this country and have always had are relatives and friends. I mean, that's the way it works. You double up with your brother and your sister. You try and avoid homelessness, just as you said, Emily, which is a huge and growing problem. You try and hold on to your house. You try and find work where you can, and you treat your kids better than you treat yourself. And that's the way it is. And so the idea that there's a couple hundred bucks more somewhere over in the state, and you have to pick up, move over there, find a place to live there, establish residency there, go through whatever rigmarole they want you to go through to apply for benefits, that, you know, if anything, I after W-2, Minnesota, this is a better argument in Minnesota, in my opinion, than it is in Wisconsin, but I just don't think of it as much of an argument.
So you would take the high-speed rail right through Wisconsin if there were one
to
Minnesota.
Oh, that high-speed rail. I remember that. Yeah, well, we didn't need that.
Are illegal immigrants at all a factor in this poverty report?
That's a really good question. Really good question, Norman. It turns out that the survey we take to determine who's poor just goes house to house. And if you knock on the door, and we do administer surveys, at least in Hispanic, and I think in up where the Hmong people are in Vietnamese or the other local language, and somebody answers, they're in the sample, and they're counted, okay? And they don't ask whether you're documented or undocumented or whatever. So somehow they're there. They aren't a huge factor. If we do change the immigration laws, suddenly they can all work legally now. And they'll all be making more money. They'll be paying taxes. They'll do the same thing the former welfare mothers did. In other words, work on the books and pay in the Social Security and into the income tax, because then you get refundable tax credits. But then you'll have to go up there. I've been many places in the middle of our lovely state with a nice Norwegian. People are pouring ice cream, and they have a nice name on their farm. And the only people touching the cows down below are brown. We have a check cashing place and so forth. I mean, the idea that you have people who want to work for really low wages because it's better than where they were, meaning in particular Mexico, that makes milk cheaper for all of us. That's taking part of it. But if you want to allow these people to become citizens, to contribute to growth as they have in the past, everyone I'm talking to, including me, other than maybe some Native Americans or immigrants here, our parents or grandparents came here at some point, and I just think it makes sense to bring them into the regular economy. I think it would be good for everybody. But yeah, they're in there. How many are in there? I don't know. We have some data on declared minorities in the Racine area and in Milwaukee, but we haven't got the money yet to go do an analysis of that. If somebody wants to know about immigrant poverty in Wisconsin, call Tim. I'm here. I'm happy to do it. More. Won't cost you a lot, but it'll cost you a little bit.
More on poverty in Wisconsin when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Americans are falling through gaping holes scissored out of America's safety net. Income inequality is real. There is an institutionalized divide between the wealthy and the poor, so that what we have now are the rich and the rest of us. We are at a critical turning point in America, and we are obsessed with the ambitious goal of changing how we think about, talk about, and act on the issue of poverty and the poor. That's from a book called The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto by Tavis Smiley and Cornell West. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Timothy Smeeting, and we are talking about the newly released Wisconsin Poverty Report. Before we get back to our own state, how about the issue that they raise there about the basic inequity in income? as the main, you know, in a country like America where there is such wealth and such high salaries among CEOs and so on, is it naive to think that we could end poverty or make a difference?
Well, you know, I think that poverty will always be something that you have with you. There is no country on earth that doesn't have some people who are poor. But you want it down, you know, certainly under 10% and certainly under 7%. Some things happen. Some people fall through the cracks. But then you want those people who fall through to bounce back, of course, the next year. But for me, the level of inequality in this country is too high. And there are a lot of well-to-do people who could pay a little bit more to help support the rest. I think the biggest problem with inequality, though, is the way it affects mobility. Poll after poll has shown that Americans are becoming concerned about inequality. That is bothering them. And the major concern is that a very small number at the top, not just the top 1%, but maybe 5 or 10%, they turn over every year too, are, you know, pulling away and leaving everybody behind. But the big issue is that your children don't have the same chance. I mean, most people who are rich in this country work really hard. They make big decisions on gazillions of dollars worth of projects. If their board is legitimate and representing the stockholders, you get more reward when you do well, but worse reward when you do worse. And so many of them, you know, deserve to be paid quite a bit of money. Not quite as much as we're paying them, probably not with all other the side benefits we're paying them, but there's a case. And most Americans think, God bless them. You know, Jobs had a great idea, or Bill Gates had a great idea, and they went out there and they started in their garage and they worked their butts off and made a lot of money. I want my kid to be like theirs. But then when you start looking, what are the chances of my kid, right, to go to a good college, to go to a good university, for me to have them in a good school and everything? And you realize that, you know, most people, middle-class Americans who made it in manufacturing or carpentry or construction, my father was a union carpenter, are realizing that, my God, you know, we need more education, we need to work harder at getting our kids to do well in school and so forth, and we don't have the same chances that the kids of the rich do.
Is part of that pulling away, do you think, related to technology? In other words,
talking
about an educational disparity.
Oh, absolutely. It's well, I mean, productivity is a good thing, we think, and productivity is more output per worker. And if you can apply more robots and more technology and do a better job, produce a better, more durable product with fewer workers, that makes the product more competitive, that makes the product better and cheaper for those who have enough money to spend on it. But the collateral damage is the fact that people who used to produce those same goods and services don't have jobs anymore because you need many fewer workers. So the idea is to retool and retrain those workers and get their kids to do better so they can go off and work with computerized machinery and high-tech too. I mean, our output per person in this country is far above where it was when the recession started. It's just that we still have 5 million people who've been unemployed for at least 6 months, and we still need another 4 or 5 million jobs to get back to the level of jobs we had. Forget about population growth or anything like that. Just get back to where we were in the end of 2007 when the recession began. So it's, you know, it's a slog, and we're not back there. This isn't 1999 in Wisconsin where you may remember if you could walk, talk, or chew bubblegum, you could get a job. Unemployment was 2 or 3%. You went to Target down the street, that's Target, and there weren't, you know, they wanted 300 workers, and they didn't have 2,000 applications. They only had 40 applications. And anybody who walked in and was willing to work for that money and looked like they could show up and do it, you got the job. Now you can sort. You can say, if you're unemployed, don't apply. In other words, it's really easy. You don't have to take a chance on somebody who never had a job. I mean, women are protected class. Aged people are protected class. All sorts of religions are a protected class. But the unemployed are not a protected class. So you can actually advertise for jobs. If you're unemployed, don't bother to apply.
I was, I gave blood recently, and the person who was part of that process said that their business, they do this little loop, you know, Madison and surrounding communities. And their business had gotten really good in Janesville once, you know, the plant shut down. People were giving plasma a couple of times a week for, what, $30, $60 a shot.
Yes. It's turns out the biggest jump in poverty, by the way, in our report this year was in Rock County. And it was a statistically big jump. It hadn't happened in before this, but now it's up. And there is a journalist who's visiting the Poverty Institute, Amy Goldstein, who's writing a book about Janesville Call When Work Leaves. And at some point, she'll be a good person to talk to about what happens when the jobs go away and what that does. I'm going to lose at least one of my employees who's going to leave the end of the year because her husband was a GM employee and was told, you want to stay with GM, you go to Lansing. And so she's moving to Lansing. I hate to lose her, but you got to do what you got to do, assuming she can sell her house in Janesville, which is not a...
Parts of Michigan are not doing so well either.
No, right. But he's got a job there, and she laughed that working at the university, we've seen no pay raises at all in the last 4 or 5 years. But her husband's pay has actually gone up, even though he wasn't receiving it. So he goes back to work now for General Motors for more than he was laid off on, even though in between when he was laid off, he certainly wasn't getting that money.
So. This Wisconsin Poverty Report, how far does it go in actually making recommendations as opposed to just reporting the status quo?
Well, we report the status quo. We don't make recommendations. Our recommendation would be to keep doing what you're doing and doing it well. What you can see this year is if things are still bad out there and you cut back, it hurts people. You're going to cut. If the economy was booming and things were getting better, if we were in North Dakota and things were getting better, you know, if we had four epics in Madison, if Milwaukee was somehow got going and poverty was falling, you know, then you probably could cut back. But you wouldn't have to because fewer people would be eligible for the programs
right.
for paying benefits.
But, of course, if you had four epics in Wisconsin, those would all be pretty much high-tech jobs.
They are
high-tech
jobs,
around to that problem.
Every one of those high-tech jobs, those people drive down Regent Street. Those people buy vegetables and fruit. Those people need coffee. Those people make the restaurants downtown go. And as a frequent traveler, the planes are all bigger going out of town now. Just don't leave on a Monday afternoon, epic Monday, because you can wait in line for a long time. But, you know, they're spinoffs. These things, they create jobs for people, you know, with their lawns and guarding the place and whatever else. And that means better, more roads or maybe more housing for them to live in, which adds to construction jobs. And so there are multiplier effects. So the primary jobs, yes, are high tech. But I spent some time on a PBS show talking in Wisconsin about this factor. And a number of people came on. And we don't have PhDs, but we got jobs at Epic because we're computer nerds. Or I mean, this is what we do. And we've had great opportunities. And now what we're seeing is a lot of people who started there are now spinning off because the digitalization of medical records is getting so big and it's so important. You know, I'll give you one example. Here's a nice example. We talked before about the American Pediatrics Association. Well, it turns out that the health of a child between creation, then the birth, and then the age two depends incredibly much on the well-being of, in particular, the baby's mother. Why don't we treat the two of them together? When I see a child as a pediatrician, I'd like to know something not just about the child. I'd like to know something about the mother. Is the mother depressed? Has she been out of work? Has she been having some problems? Did she have a bad delivery? Were there other issues so that I can treat the baby better with the mother and maybe even treat the two of them together in some way? Now, our system isn't set up to do that. But if you've got medical records and they're seeing someone in the same system, you can do this. You can actually, I can sit down with an infant, and before I go in to see that infant, I can have a quick look at the mother's, you know, the mother's health history and the history of the pregnancy and other things that will allow me to do better for the kid and then maybe better for the both of them. So
that's a low to no cost improvement.
It is. It's a low to no cost improvement. You need permission, of course, but if it's like Badger Care and the parent and the child are in the same delivery system, you can do it. I mean, it's technologically possible now between the Associated Physicians, Meritor people, and the university people. They're just at war. So when I see people from the two sides, you know, they all have great medical electronic records. They all can follow me here and there, but they can't talk to one another.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about health care a little bit more in terms of the relationship between health care and poverty. I know when my husband, who's a physician, was coming back from Chicago, and there was an accident on the road. The first thing out of this guy's mouth, and his car had flipped, was, don't take me to the ER. I don't have health insurance. I can't afford this. He was worrying about the finances while he's bleeding. His car is flipped. And I've had people in the program I do for people at the poverty level, where the reason they fell into poverty is medical expenses. Absolutely. That they couldn't pay. Can you say something? Is that something that the Wisconsin Poverty Report touched on? Is the causes of poverty, or the sort of process where you can have someone who was maybe in the middle class and fell into poverty?
Well, Emily, we actually do. We do this. And the Wisconsin Poverty Report adds benefits, but it also looks at costs. So the poverty line in the Wisconsin report and the poverty line in the federal supplemental measure is based on what a low-income family spends on food, clothing, and shelter. And you add maybe 10 or 15% more for other things, okay? But if you've got a big medical expense, you get pulled down into poverty. And we record that, actually. We take account of that in the Wisconsin poverty measure. We also take account of the cost of going to work, and we take account of the cost of child care if you're not subsidized all the time. So these are all things which reduce the money you've got for food, clothing, and shelter, and which are counted in the Wisconsin Poverty Report. The nice thing here is that our Badger Care system does a pretty good job, and the ACA will do a good job, in limiting your out-of-pocket expenses. There'll be stop losses, and you'll have fewer people in this situation. But it's a uniquely American thing, as you know, that the first thing they want to know is your insurance status before anybody treats you. Mm-hmm. Even if they're supposed to treat you first because federal funds were used to build the hospital or the clinic that you're in. But that's a part of it. And bankruptcy for medical care expenses and what you have to pay is important. And it's really important for the elderly. So the elderly poverty rate in the Wisconsin Poverty Report is above the federal official rate, primarily because a lot of low-income people live in states or are in programs or in places where they don't get help with paying for their health care expenses other than Medicare, and they can spend down into poverty. I mean, you have people out there, it's either heat or eat, and you're living on a fixed income. You've got just your Social Security, and, you know, you've got your Medicare, and then you had to go in the hospital or see a doctor, and you got a bill that you have to pay and so on, and you can spend down into poverty. So we take account of that, too, and that's the biggest thing that separates elderly poverty in the Wisconsin Poverty Report from the official poverty measure.
So are you saying that as the recession made life more difficult for most people in Wisconsin, I guess you could say, the idea was actually to reduce benefits to those below the poverty line?
Well, you know, there's just so much. Quite often you see a number and it's big and it's growing. And so you say, my gosh, what are we doing here? You know, there must be a scandal. Why do so many people need so much food stamps? Why do 1 in 6 people in Wisconsin get it? In some Florida counties, why do 1 in 3 people get it? It's because they're poor. It's because they don't have jobs. It's because they're needy. That's why. That's my response. Now, there is some, you can find little instances, you know, people get on the radio and call and say, I know somebody who cheats. They use their food stamps. They sell their card to get drugs. Well, everybody knows somebody who did something somewhere, but it's by and large not the vast majority of people. They need this. This is how they make ends meet. Between the food pantry at the end of the month and your debit card for a food share at the beginning of the month, that's how you feed your family. And we can, in this country, no matter what CEOs make or no matter what the rest of us make, we can afford to feed people. We can afford to buy people food. Not booze again, not paper, no alcohol, no napkins, none of that, just FOOD. That's all. And we double them at the farmer's market, too. If you buy something at the farmer's market, your food share price is half. And you pay for it with your food share debit card, your food share price is half of the price.
It does raise an interesting question about the private sector and how that might be more involved in this whole process.
Yeah, it does. The private sector, I mean, one of the nice thing about Madison is that we have more nonprofits per capita here than anywhere. We have churches which provide napkins and paper for people who would otherwise get SNAP. We do the best we can to help people here. Porchlight and Schoolers is a great example in what they do. But somehow the answer to poverty is having a job that pays enough to support you and your family. You feel better about it. Your children feel better about it. We just aren't there now. This is a big, gut-wrenching recession, and we're not out of it, particularly at the lower end. And there are a lot of people out there whose skills aren't as valuable as they used to be now. Okay. They lost their job, and they got to come back for less.
Do we want to come back to why Wisconsin is number 48 in job creation?
Oh, it's a difficult thing to say. I don't know all the answers. You could talk to Laura Dresser at Cows or somebody who's much more informed than I am. But, I mean, we're trying to bring back manufacturing. And manufacturing is going to come back. Output is going to come back. But not the number of workers and
right.
the number of jobs.
Because of
we
automation.
We just really have to, you know, do more and better in training people for the jobs we have. Employers keep saying, well, we can't find people who will do X and Y. Well, get involved. Go to your community college. Go to your local training programs and say, if you got somebody who can do X and Y, we'll give them a job. Or, in fact, let the person apprentice at a lower wage for you and then grow into something better. Get involved. I mean, if I were running a business in Wisconsin, I'd love wonderful welders and, you know, who with 10 years experience who would work for 10 bucks an hour, but they don't. I mean, Laura, the Cows report, Laura's shown that there are some welders in this state who make 50 bucks an hour, and then there's others who make 12 or 13 bucks an hour. And obviously there's a difference in quality and responsibility and so forth. But if you need more welders, then let's go train welders. And if the welders do better, you pay them more than 12 bucks an hour. I mean, certainly more than 10 bucks an hour. So it's hard. The big problem was our employment in manufacturing is what we were built on. And that was our strength before 2007. We made those SUVs. We made those Evinrude outboard motors. We made those Harley Davidsons. We produced those Manitowoc ice machines. We were a manufacturing state. We produced wood products and so forth and so on. And those industries are changing very rapidly. And in order to be competitive, you need more and more capital and fewer workers. So employment growth has been modest in manufacturing, but not great. Construction went way down, but it's starting to bounce back up now because, not because of the university, but because smart developers saw that you're not going to be able to borrow 3% forever, and we might as well do
it now. There's a lot of construction. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much of it's speculative, but there seems to be a lot of it.
There's a nice story today in the Washington Post that they've overbuilt rental housing now in Washington, and which means rents are going to fall, which is probably a good thing. It's just, this was a gut-wrenching recession, and just getting out of it. People, you know, are stuck in their homes because they're underwater. You know, you can't sell it for as much as you owe on it and so forth. That's changing a little bit. We're very slowly climbing out of this, but we're not out of it yet. And the people at the bottom with the least skills are the ones whose skills are least important anymore are the ones who are in trouble. They're the ones who need an earned income credit, a refundable tax credit. They're the ones who need SNAP to feed them and their kids, and that's what they're getting. And we should be happy we're doing this. This is important. I said last year and this year, Wisconsin, I should be proud of how well they're doing, but we should also realize this year now, the bottom line is that cutting back on these programs until the economy really gets going is going to push some more people into poverty. It's going to hurt.
Well, let's talk about Milwaukee and some other aspects of Wisconsin's poverty problem when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Timothy Smeeting. He is involved with the Wisconsin Poverty Report, which is just out in its fifth year. And we've mentioned Milwaukee. Is that representative of Wisconsin, or is it a place unto itself?
Well, that's a really interesting question. It turns out that for a long, long time, for 20, 30 years, Central City, Milwaukee has been a bad place to be. There's a lot of crime, not very good schools, employment disappearing, a lot of out-of-wedlock childbirth, and a lot of big urban city issues, which have only gotten worse. Now, it's interesting that people in Milwaukee, the growth of food stamp use or food share use in Milwaukee is less than it is in other counties because they were already receiving it. So I'd say two-thirds of the growth in use of food share in Wisconsin is outside Milwaukee. But Milwaukee's a big issue. Milwaukee's got everything an urban poverty place has, or rich suburbs around it, even within the county, much less you don't have to go to Waukesha or Ozaukee. You can just go to Cedarburg or Whitefish Bay or other places which are in Milwaukee County, but where the poverty rates are about 5% compared to 35%. So you're in the central city of Milwaukee where jobs are fewer and fewer and far between without adequate transportation to get out the Blue Mound Road or whatever those other roads are you pass when you drive into Milwaukee where some jobs are. The schools aren't doing well, haven't done well, still aren't doing well there. You're not, you know, your chance, if you go to one of Milwaukee's central city schools, your chances of graduating are only about 40-45%. And if you don't have a high school degree in this economy, you just might as well hang it up. And unfortunately, in particular minorities, but virtually everyone who doesn't get a high school degree, a huge number, 60-70% of high school dropouts end up in trouble with the criminal justice system, and that costs us way more than good schools. So, I mean, we really need efforts to make the next generation come along there. We need creative efforts to make sure that Milwaukee, central city Milwaukee, doesn't turn out to be Detroit. In other words, a total shell of a city. There are many wonderful things about Milwaukee and many wonderful people trying to do things about them. They just have to keep doing it and doing it better and smarter. If we could reduce teenage out-of-wedlock childbearing, that would be huge. The way you teach that is very simple. All of us want our children to graduate from school, get a job, find a partner, make a plan, and have a baby. Now take that string and put have a baby first. Before you finish school,
Everything else goes on track.
Have a partner, you don't have a job, and you never had a plan. And so the idea is to convince people that they should continue to work at school, that there's a future if they work there, and that it's a better future for them than having a child right now. Of course, when you graduate from school and find a partner, get together and make a life. But unfortunately, particularly for men, we're not doing that well. So we have big issues. A man under 30 is more likely than other ages. If you're not a high school graduate, to have fathered a child or more than one child, and then you owe child support for that child. And if you're jobless or if you're in jail, that child support just builds up. And so when it builds up, if you go out and you earn a dollar in the above-ground economy, they claw 50 cents of it back directly. And so why work in that economy? Work in the underground economy. And sometimes you can get in trouble doing that. Mm-hmm. And so it's a difficult problem. It's not unlike Newark, New Jersey, Gary, Indiana, and other places, not like Buffalo where I grew up, unlike Buffalo and certain parts of Cleveland and certainly Detroit, where the inner cities just totally collapsing, where the employment base isn't there anymore. I mean, another good example is the fact that not just in this state, but we've lost over 1 million jobs in the public sector over this recession. And those aren't primarily jobs that our graduate students and La Follette are losing. They're jobs that people who drove buses or cleaned streets or, you know, were essentially low-skilled people could find a decent job that paid benefits in the public sector. And that's not there anymore. So it's really hard without a good education and without some sort of stable family support. And Milwaukee is short on all of those. So even when the economy recovers, we're going to have trouble in Milwaukee and many other parts of the state, including where we are. The economy's recovered pretty well, but not in central city Milwaukee. It's really still bad and with a lot of classic problems of poor housing, bad neighborhoods, crime, unstable families, and whatever.
Well, to play devil's advocate, you said that the poverty report, when Norman asked about, you know, does it lead to proposals for mm-hmm. solutions, and you said more or less it reports mm-hmm. the status quo. Mm-hmm. But what if somebody said, well, what good is a poverty report if it just gives us this sort of bad news and some bad statistics and says, you know, things are bad in Milwaukee and children are poor. If it doesn't translate into a call to action, what good is it?
I think that's a good question. And so now I'm speaking for me, Tim Smeeting. I'm not speaking for the Institute for Research on Poverty any more than you guys are speaking for Wisconsin Public Radio. You're speaking for you. I'm speaking for me. I think we need to do better at finding jobs for low-skilled people to get them trained, to get them connected to employment. We'll have a big research conference on that here next summer with the leading people in the country on that. There are ideas. There are things you can do that work. We just have to do them.
What?
One thing is trying to subsidize jobs or get employers involved in training, for instance. Another thing is to make community colleges more relevant and responsible, particularly to low-skill kids. 20% of the people in community colleges already have a bachelor's degree. They got their bachelor's degree in English in Whitewater, and there's no jobs in English, and they want to come back and be a nursing technician or a radio technician or whatever, and that's where they're going to get more low-income people into those jobs. Try and get employers to hire disadvantaged people and to give them a chance. Tell them not to exclude the unemployed. A big thing we could do is to actively try and get young first offenders who come out of jail into a job that will cost us much less than them going back to Green Bay or back to another one of our penal facilities that will make their family life better and so forth. There's a lot of things we could do, and we're just not doing them now because the state is squeezed hard. And we could. A good example is a very nice man, a legislator from Wausau. I've forgotten his name, but we sat talking, and we're talking about early childhood education. And he said, Tim, you know, you're right. We're convinced. We really do need to do more to get kids ready for school. But I have to go back to Wausau and talk to the superintendent about whether they're going to combine the second grade and the third grade or the second grade and the first grade next year because we don't have enough money to hire another teacher. And you want me to go step up and do a match and bring in federal money and get going with early childhood education? I can't do it. Well, maybe next month or next year you can. We just really need to do that. We need to make efforts. We need to help people to help themselves. And there's lots of other things we could say. But I think right now holding on to what we've got, the safety net we've got, is really important. And then trying to promote employment, trying to bring more firms into the state, trying to get the economy going, and not just in manufacturing, I will tell you. I'm not alone. I've had this talk many times with people like Tom Hefty, who used to run Blue Cross Blue Shield, and other people, and with our new chancellor, who's going to do her best, I know, to really get the economy going and to have, you know, the university contribute what it can in terms of what leads to more employment and better employment and new firms and so forth, which is going to be good for the state.
What do you think is a reasonable expectation, a reasonable goal for next year's Wisconsin Poverty Report, a year from now?
Well, it would be really good to find that the market income poverty rate had flattened out, or there was no increase in market income poverty, which meant that instead of that, there were still about 25% of people who were poor just based on the market income. Okay, that means the markets are doing better, and it would be even better if that number were falling. Okay, that's a sign of a strong economy where people are finding jobs and where on their own, just on their own efforts, they're helping to avoid poverty. The fact that we have falling teen pregnancy rates in all of our counties, which is really good. We have falling incarceration rates now, too, which is good. But we need to help these people, who young people in particular, who are floundering around to get jobs. The college graduates will do okay, all right? You know, and they've got a home to go home to, and that maybe it should be good for them. They can build up some money. They can look take a little bit longer trying to find a good job. But it's the kids who graduate from, you know, high school just barely or not at all, who are at the end of every job training. And we need to find productive things for them to do. The public sector can help. The private sector can help. And I really think that's a big social responsibility for us to give these people who will be the parents of the kids who will try to support, and some are still kids themselves, a chance at a better life. I really need to do that. So that's what I think.
Well, thanks for sharing your thoughts and your discoveries with us, Timothy Smeeting.
Thank you very much, Norman, and thank you, Emily.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air, and thanks to our engineers, Joe Hartke and Brittany Tripp.